and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast on CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is podcast number 252. As I said last week, you're not getting to escape from the Celtic Underground podcast that easily. Maybe this summer, Celtic games may have finished, the team may be back in training with a few signings taking place, and the next game might not be until the Champions League on the 14th of July, and even at that, we're playing a team from a country with a population of 350,000, so we might not have new signings in place. So there may not be much to talk about, but we are going to find it. Last week, St Anthony brought you the bold teacher alike, Mr Graham Spears. This week, we find you the young and internet savvy and up on the rules, Mr Grant Russell of STV. Keep wanting to call him Russell Grant for obvious reasons, or STV Grant for those of you on Twitter who will know him. Either way, we had a chat which demonstrated he genuinely isn't a Rangers fan in the media masquerading as a supporter of a lower team. He is a Livingston fan. He explained all that. And we then went on to have a wider discussion about better coverage for Scottish football in the media, whether that be on the TV or wherever, better production values, etc, etc. So, that's enough of the intro. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Grant Russell, at STV Grant, Mr. Knows All The Rules. So I'm joined by Grant Russell from STV, and I find it difficult to call you Grant Russell because you are STV Grant. Everybody at STV has a first name of STV.
It's true.
And a surname of a Christian name. So one of the things just to establish before we get going is I know why St Mirren have got such low average attendances in Scottish football. It's because every St Mirren fan is a journalist. But of course we know that's nonsense. However, you genuinely are not a Rangers fan, which is quite peculiar in the press. You are a Livingston fan, so
prove my credentials. Yes. Pretty much is what you're going to say.
Yes, exactly.
Well, my family weren't really into football. That's the thing. I wasn't really brought up with a kind of, I don't remember, I mean, I was born in 1987. I don't remember Euro 92. I don't remember World Cup 94, which is probably a strange thing for a 5-7-year-old kid. Sorry, I'm making you feel old here. But
it's made me feel ancient. I can just about remember Seth Meyer in the 74 World Cup. I can absolutely remember Willie Johnson getting returned home early from the 78 World Cup.
So it was a strange thing. I genuinely recall nothing of these football tournaments. But then in 1995, Livingston came to town. Mm-hmm. I was staying in Craigshill in Livingston. That's where we live, one of the areas of Livingston. And it was just this curious thing. I played football with my friends, but the idea of professional football was kind of lost to me. So it was a new and intriguing thing, and I actually created a huge buzz in the town because 4,000 people. I mean, there was people on the hill next to the stadium watching the first game. Such was the level of intrigue. I wasn't one of them. I eventually got along to my first Livingston game not long into 1996. And, you know, how old would I have been then? I was just after my 9th birthday. And I suppose you take a kid of 5-6 to football and they suddenly think, what is this crazy, wonderful world, the colour, the noise? Yeah. But it was the same for a 9-year-old kid as well. It was just something I never experienced before in my life. And I was immediately hooked. And that was third division football. And granted, Livingston, I was spoiled through my kind of formative years in football because Livingston just won everything. Mm-hmm. And we were crying on the day they lost the promotion from the second to the first division because all we knew was success.
Mate.
So, Livingston threw a lot of money at things. So it was certainly money perhaps didn't have or other people's money. But it was a crest of a wave. I remember great players, Barry Wilson, David Bingham, we had John Robertson in the twilight of his career, and that went on and went on. And we got to the SPL, third in the SPL. Dominic Keane would always talk about us being the third force and people would laugh at him, and all of a sudden there we were. We'd finished third, we qualified for European football. Wonderful players like David Fernandes, who Celtic ruined, by the way.
I think I always felt Celtic knew there was a player there.
Yeah.
And took him because we were in that period where
we would just go and pick the best player in Scotland because he's bound to be a good player.
It was a done thing.
I don't actually know if anybody took any analysis of, but does he fit into our system?
That was pretty much it. You would just pick up the player and then worry about afterwards whether he was going to be in your team or not. Yeah. And you'd weakened your...
Like Agat, who started as a forward at Hibs.
And Wraith before.
And ended up as a right back for us.
Yeah. They suddenly found this way to fit him into the team, otherwise he'd be out the door.
Yeah.
But I mean, to go back to Livingston briefly, so with our European adventures, I wasn't in Liechtenstein for the first game because so confident was I that we would get to the next round, I would save my pocket money, or rather my mother would pay for me to go to the next game. She was happy to get me out of the house, so I was able to go to the football. And I'll never forget that heart-stopping moment. We had drawn 1-1 in Liechtenstein in the first game. It came out to Almondfield. It was 0-0. It must have been 93rd, 94th minute, and they had a corner. And the boy had been a bit of a hash of it, and Stuart Lovell went to clear it and had just sliced it pretty much back to their player, and next thing the ball was in the net. So I'm thinking, dream of seeing Livingston abroad in tatters, what an idiot I am, 15 at the time. And it turned out the referee had actually blown the whistle when Stuart Lovell had made his poor contact with the ball. So I got my adventure, got to go to Graz. I was in the background on Scotland Today as Raman was vox popping people, which is something I dug out the photo. I actually got the tape out not long ago to show him me in the background as he's vox popping people again, making someone feel ancient. But yeah, that's the credentials, and we won the cup obviously after that. And I must say the interest has waned, unfortunately, in my, you know, the later years. Livingston have been through a lot of turbulent times, which and I worked there as well. I suppose it's the dream of any person who supports a team to then suddenly be immersed in their day-to-day life, which I did for a year. I suppose my professional life now is kind of still a supporter. I still call myself a supporter, but and follow the team's fortunes. But when it comes to seeing them or actively engaging, it's my fault, it's the club's fault as well, that I'm not at that level anymore. I don't get the same excitement from Livingston anymore. Perhaps I've went back, I'd be hooked again.
So how did you get into STV? You were working at Livingston for a year.
Yeah, I did a journalism course at Glasgow Caledonian, and then my first job in the media was reading the travel reports on the radio. It was a company called Traffic Link, and you were a central base, and you would read travel reports on Wave 102, which was in Edinburgh. Talk 107 in Edinburgh, Wave 102 in Dundee, stationed on my own real radio, etc., etc. Wave 102 heard my voice, went to know my background, ended up doing some shifts there. Then the opportunity came up at Livingston. The Italian owner turned up, and the guy at the time, David Stoker, suddenly vanished the next day. I think he had unpaid bills that hadn't been fulfilled, so suddenly an opportunity came up. I volunteered my services and was there for a year. What a wonderful year that was, not getting paid on time. And a year in the life of alongside Angelo Massoni. Wow. I said I should have written a book at the time.
Because it's not the main stand isn't the deepest of things, so it's not as if, like at Celtic or Ibrox, an employee could be at one end and never bump into Peter Lawwell or whoever it is, or the owner of the day at Ibrox. At Livingston, you'd have met him every day if he was in, or you had interacted with all the management people every day.
I mean, when he became so entrenched at the end, when he wasn't paying people, I mean, I was probably one of the closest people to him. I mean, rightly or wrongly, because of the job I was in, you just witnessed this absolute meltdown of a man who had no money, because these people had left him, that had money when they'd seen the severity of the situation at the club, whatever that was. And then he refused to back out, and he just hadn't paid wages. He managed to pay the players normally, eventually, once they had to go on strike a few times. And he got to the stage where the council just said, look, you've not paid your rent for, I can't remember how many months it was, probably maybe in the whole year. Let's say it was 6 months, to be fair to Angelo. And they pushed for the administration order, and that was the end of it. And that was kind of it for me. My girlfriend at the time, now wife, basically said, you need to get out of that situation, and she did. I mean, I loved it there despite all the craziness. What a dream to, and it was what a great proper first job in the media, because I'd worked in a newsroom and doing travel reports, doing radio reports, but suddenly I was on my own. I had my own ideas, and it was just like this. Twitter was coming along right at the end, and I could still knew how to build a basic website. I can never do it these days. And it's just fantastic to be able to do, and I got to write the Livingston programme. When I was a 9-10 year old boy and first started going to them, I used to make my own programmes when I got home at night.
I suppose it's like a friend of mine who's an accountant said he learned more in a company that was failing, fighting fire, than he would have done.
I can understand that.
So it would be the same thing. You would learn more having to be
crisis management.
Yeah, all the jobs in the crisis management.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So was he a bad guy or a daft guy?
Whatever I see here, someone's going to probably hold it against me some point in the future. I didn't think he was a bad guy. He was painted as a crook, as a desperado, if you like. I just think, I don't know what his intentions were, Livingston, apart from to say he always wanted to buy the stadium. So perhaps it was, I'll buy the stadium, then I'll have this great asset, and I can do this and I can do that, and then I can bring players over, sell them on. He was an agent, a lawyer or agent, yeah, by initial trade. I mean, he was involved in Shinjuku Nakamura coming over, him and another guy a long time ago. Then he just got in too deep, and he didn't have the money to carry on, and in a way, he should have held his hands up, and whether it was pride, whether it was...
Well, somebody once put it to me, and I'll not use the word they used. Some people do you wrong in business because they are bad guys.
Hmm.
It doesn't really work unless I use the actual word. I don't really want to use it because I then have to put an explicit on a podcast and I can't get to do it. Because with a B and sounds like a dog, right? Some people do it because they are that. Some people do it. Do you end up being the wrong side of bad business because they're daft?
Mm.
That one.
Mm-hmm.
So some guy may be an evil, this word. Some people might be a daft, this word. But if you're on the receiving end, they're just a...
Yeah,
this word.
Yeah, of course. He was naive, is what struck me. And the more desperate he got, the more arrogant and... shut people off. You just became that way. Everyone became the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Even reasoned people that you would know for years suddenly
became
the enemy.
Against you.
Of course.
So, how did you go? Not how did you go to, from there to STD, but have you sort of the thing? I suppose you've got a reputation for, is the best way to put it. The thing you've got a reputation for on Twitter amongst fans is being the technical guy.
Right.
The guy who will know
the
answer to the rules.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I actually find this a weird concept to be speaking to a journalist and saying, so,
you know what
tell me how
about.
You know what you're talking about.
Sort
you know,
comment.
See your laugh there. One of the things that's bugged me for years is if I was to pick up the phone to my brother, he would tell me exactly the results that will need to happen in the next 12 months for England to lose their fourth Champions League place.
Mm-hmm.
My brother is not some Oxford University professor in mathematics. He's just a guy who pays attention basically to Bert's UEFA site thing.
Yeah, Bert Cassidy, what a wonderful resource. Yeah.
Yeah, so basically he reads Bert's website and is able to tell me. What's bugged me for years is the concept of coefficient. You need to be a genius to work that out. No, you don't.
You definitely don't.
Just tell me.
It's maths.
Yeah. So, Mr. Journalist, will Celtic go in at the second or first round of qualifying? Oh, that's down to the coefficient. You need to be a genius to work that out. Move on. No, not move on. Tell me. So, how have you become... Was it a conscious decision to become the rules guy who knew the rules, or do you think it's just doing your job?
Well, to wind it back one stage, it's been a lot about being in the right place at the right time. I got to Livingston because I was in the right place at the right time. I got a job at STV doing their STV player, putting the shows on, and myself and Andy Coyle were at right place, right time. Suddenly needed someone, new guys to do the sport website, so right place, right time. Then Twitter came along and no one knew what to do with this damn thing, and suddenly we were right place, right time. We were early adopters, and the first big thing for us that really kicked it on was the referee strike.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically journalism here is our working out. Well, we've called the Czech FA and they say they're not sending referees, and we've called the Portuguese FA and they're sending two assistants and one referee, you know, and so we started building this reputation, and it just built from there. Right place, right time. How did I get on to being the technical guy? I don't know. I think if you're doing a job, not everyone can say that they're fortunate enough to do this by a long extent, but if you're doing a job, you're probably doing it because if you're lucky to do a job, it's because you're passionate about it. You can be doing a job that you hate and it's mundane and it's 9 to 5 and you just happen to get a paycheck at the end of it all. I was this guy who had been reading the travel on the radio, had loved football as a kid, who went in to upload Coronation Street and Emmerdale to the STV website, who suddenly had the world at his feet of people asking him questions about Scottish football and like some sort of expert and you know, what a position to be in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a reputation that's built. I mean, I can't say it was a conscious decision. It's just something you care about. And it doesn't necessarily have to be coefficients. I'm going to do the referee stuff as well, or do... What else do I do? It's just... People might see it as geeky, or some people might see it as niche. And it shouldn't be.
Yeah, it's only become niche because the other journalists... So one of the things would be... And he may or may not have said this, but it's the type of thing, and it's a disclaimer for you that you're not saying this. Someone like Hugh Keevans... I'm a football journalist. I didn't get into football journalism to have to be talking every day about finances. Mm-hmm. It would be the type of thing that you would hear trotted out, particularly between 2011 and today, with all the stuff at Rangers. Whereas myself and my friend's attitude is, if I'm doing a job and the nature of that job starts to evolve, mm-hmm. then the nature of the job has evolved. Tough titty to me.
I wonder.
Also, from what I never understood, why I might not understand a deed of conditions coming in relation to somebody's land title for a football team. But if I worked in a newspaper or any other media organisation, there will be a guy somewhere on my floor, somewhere down the corridor, yeah. or in the floor below or the floor above, who does, and that's... I've never understood why they didn't go along and knock on the door to the finance editor and saying, look, we in the sports department need a bit of help here. We're not asking you to write our pieces, but we are asking you to give us some input where we should be looking.
I might come across as the guy on Twitter sometimes who thinks he knows everything, but I'd rather be that guy than the guy that knows nothing. And I don't know everything, but if it's something I don't know, I'll go and ask, and I'll learn about a subject. And that's a basic principle of journalism. If you go in, if it's something you don't, if you come across something, you explaining it to the reader or the viewer. If you can't explain what the hell's going on there, then well, you better find out so you can explain it, or you're failing in your job. In the defence of what we would call perhaps an old school journalist, I mean, the job must have been the same for years and years and years on end. You're reporting on football, of course, with Celtic in the 90s, which was probably the kind of first major financial kind of situation we ever had in Scottish football in the modern day. I don't want to call it complacency, because again, that's not fair as well, but I can understand to an extent, that's your job. You're very good at your job, what it is. And suddenly, it dramatically changes overnight. And you've got young bucks like me coming in and looks like he thinks he knows everything. Because you learn, like when we were talking about Rangers financial stuff, I mean, Mike Farrell, for example, SCB, when Rangers administration and subsequent liquidation and so on was happening, he was just so on the money, because a young guy who came in and thought, I'm going to devote myself to this story, I'm going to learn what I don't know, and I'm going to be at the forefront of it. So he was in a fortunate position, he was new, and he was able to evolve, and he's got the quick mind and so on. But if you've been in a job for so long, you're doing it a certain way, and there was never any threat of a change. Well, I can understand to an extent, but I'm very much of the opinion that I can even see myself now. I see the way digital trends are going, and I think I can see that from that perspective as well. Well, I need to evolve. I mean, I've always been someone who's constantly about evolution, because you need to be ahead of the game, whether it's about a story, whether it's about a technology, how you're getting your content out there. I can even feel myself now, the complacency can creep in.
Yeah, but that's where, in general, and not to blow smoke up you guys, but if I was to just compare on a straightforward basis of, predominantly in Scotland, we've got two media outlets, we've got STV and BBC, and where you guys, from my perspective, appear to have benefited, there was definitely a period during the worst of the Rangers time. When I say the worst of the Rangers time, I mean the worst of the knuckle draggers wanting to shoot the messenger time. There patently appeared to be an edict from the BBC that their guys had not to engage on Twitter. And you guys continue to engage.
Yeah. Maybe more for less.
Yeah, but at least you're engaging.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a complete lunatic on there, you can just ignore him.
Yeah, but, I mean, first and foremost, I don't agree with the philosophy of, well, fingers in the ears and blindfold on, can't see, can't hear what you're saying. Of course you do. It's going to matter. So if you're not responding, if you're not responding to folk, well, the conversation probably dies off anyway.
Yeah,
I haven't made the mistake of someone will put a rod out with some juicy bait on the end, and I'll bite, and I'll suddenly find that my evening, where I was going to be doing X, Y, and Z, I've been sitting on Twitter for 4 hours arguing about.
Yeah, because you're arguing with a guy that you think you're nuts.
No, I'm arguing with a guy where I think I can change his point of view, because
sorry,
I think I'm right.
The reason the wrong was that you're not, because you sometimes go down an argument when you know you should just stop the conversation, but you just think your position is so unreasonable, I must be able to change your opinion.
I wouldn't have that conversation in a pub. I'd walk away from it. But it's something, I don't know what it is. I've never been able to put my finger on why I constantly want to keep it going. It's not an ego thing. It's not I said I want to show this person that what they're saying is not right and I want to try and convince them. Yes, but I don't go in, that's not my general outlook on life, that I'm right and you're going to listen to what the hell I'm going to say, so I'm going to tell you how I'm right. That's not my general outlook on life. No, I just like conversation. I like speaking to people. And I think that kind of strips it right back to what us guys at STV Sport are. We're just football fans who have managed to get into this profession for whatever reason. We're good at it and we just want to talk football. I'd say that's probably the same about guys at every publication, every newspaper, at the BBC, at Sky, I don't know, but for whatever reason, whether it's something that they don't have the time, they don't have the ability in terms of any enforcement of a policy in the company, they're not at the same engagement level of us. Maybe we're all just too young and unattached and nothing better to do with our lives. And that's all changed from any of
us.
So,
if there's any female listeners out there, the STV guys, just go onto their profiles.
I'm married, by the way.
Grant's married, but any of the others, if you fancy them, they're free for a night out. Otherwise, they're just sitting at home trolling the internet like young guys do.
Well, I put the picture of young Graham Ruffin on Twitter today, who brought his laptop, his MacBook along to a night out one time. That's the standard right there. He's so angry I brought that on. What it is, we're not a special breed. I hate to think we are. We're not. We just, I don't know. It's an innate passion and a platform.
Which then leads on to the reason you're in here. That sort of half an hour was an intro into about you. But one of the things I wanted to speak about is that what you're getting out of the football. You mentioned that old fashioned journalistic Hugh Keevans is, where you turn up at a game happens and then the game finishes and you write the report beforehand of there's a game happening today, and then the next day you write a report of a game happened yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I'm simplifying, but that's how football was. And football fans, or a certain section of football fans, want more out of it.
Yep.
Which is what you guys do. I think that's where the frustration is now creeping in about the lack of better coverage of Scottish football, which for many of us, that better coverage would lead to a better commercialisation of the game, which would lead to better income generation for the game, which would lead to better players on the park, which would lead to a better product, which would lead to better media coverage, which would lead to more commercialisation, which would lead to more money, etc., etc., etc.
I think we need to start and say, whose responsibility is it? Whose responsibility is it? It's clearly incumbent on the media companies to try and get the most out of what they get. And if they have, let's say, something like Premiership rights, then should to commercialise that, because 5 years down the line it might mean a bigger commercial deal if they're getting the audience and so on. But the way Scottish football is and the way things are filmed, the way people talk about the league, I mean, we look right back to English Premier League 1992, Sky came along, chucked loads of money at it, said it and blew smoke up its backside and said it's the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah.
And eventually we believed it because, well, we believed it in the beginning, and then the money came in, the commercial revenues came in, as you said, and it gets to this, you know, a huge thing it is today. Who's it incumbent on in Scotland to start that process?
Well,
I think it's the league and the clubs have to take the initiative. What? I have so many people always come to me on Twitter and say, why don't STV spend X, Y, and Z on Scottish football? And I'll go, yeah, well, why don't they? I don't know. I'd love it if they did. Of course I would, because it would mean we can do so much more stuff because we're all so passionate about it in the editorial team.
I would put, like all things in life, I don't think it's black and white answer.
Mm.
I think the BBC have a problem because they are not a commercial entity. So the BBC not being commercial and being publicly funded, I think, have an obligation. If 8% of the UK's population is in Scotland, they have an obligation, I would suggest, since football is the nation's national sport, UK-wide nation, talking about, we have an obligation to at least spend 8% of the money that they spend on English football on Scottish football.
Yeah, no.
Which they don't.
Yeah. Oh.
So as a publicly funded entity, I think that's a problem. STV, there's two ways of looking at it. If I was in STV management, I would turn around and say, well, we do very well nicely out of sticking our on our, the whatever rights we've got, sticking them online and having STV grant, STV Andy, etc., generating hits to our website. And we'd perform a service because Sky showed the live games and they paid more than we can afford for that. And BBC have a highlights programme which fulfills a highlights need. Is the Scottish market really big enough to have two highlights programmes on? Would be what I would say if I was in STV management. So we stick them online for people to access remotely and then we do Scottish football. My counter to that would be STV make a lot of money, relatively speaking, for little investment out of Scottish football. They're a net receiver from Scottish football without enhancing the product.
Okay, but who's to blame? That STV's fault?
No. In a commercial world, that's what I might do.
Yeah.
So then the fault lies for me in the Scottish game, because if I'm in charge, I'm going to say, thanks Mr. STV, there's the door, come back when you've got a big chequebook. And every time STV came to the door, how big's your chequebook? Get to. See when your chequebook's this size, and see when you're not. Genuinely, that's what I would say. Your chequebook's so small, your journalists are paying to come and watch the football. Because you're contributing so little to our game, but making money out of it because you talk about it, and you get hits to your website talking about it. I'm charging your journalists until you start getting serious about your chequebooks. That's what I would say if I was in charge. To STV. So whose fault is it? It's the game's fault for not having the balls to have those types of conversations.
It's twofold for the, let's say, the SPFL, because they run league football in the country. We'll keep it confined to them. It's twofold for them. Firstly, do they do enough to create a marketable, a commercially viable product that any private broadcaster in Scotland would want to throw money at? That would be able to, I'm going to say throw money at it, it's going to be throwing other people, it's going to be throwing advertisers money at it.
Yeah,
So, are you creating
enough to justify throwing your advertisers money at it?
Exactly. And that is incumbent on the league. So it's not incumbent on a broadcaster to throw money at something that's not going to make money back for them. As much as I would love it, of course, if suddenly STV could find £1 million just sitting in their back pockets and want to throw it at Scottish football. Well, I've got so many great ideas. There's so many good things we could do.
£5 million.
Yes, Mr. Doncaster. But I can completely sympathise with it with a contrary point of view, and I genuinely don't know if this would be the reasoning, but it's from a purely commercial point of view. I would say, well, how am I going to make money out of Scottish football? You and I sitting here know Scottish football's good.
Mm-hmm.
Order and on great. We've got good stories which can generate, marketed correctly, can generate good commercial revenues and get bums on seats as well. It's got so many good teams as well, so many good matchups, so many good young promising players. It's not like the 90s where we had the headline names.
But who's telling the stories?
Well, it has to be. Well, funny, I had this conversation about 2 years ago. Who, and I hate using the word, but who's dictating the narrative of Scottish football? And we allow it to be the media platforms.
We allow it to be the tabloids who want to sell newspapers and have good cop, bad cop stories about Celtic Rangers.
Right, and even to a less extent, you allow it to be any member of any media. They tell the story. They go to a news conference, they say, well, we're going to try and ask him this question, and this is what we're doing, that's what he's going to be written about Scottish football today. Okay, who's taking the bull by the horns and providing the alternative narrative? Why are the SPFL not investing in a website where they're saying, well, this is the story of the day, and here's the behind the scenes content at Aberdeen Football Club, and here's an interview with the Motherwell manager, and here's something really interesting to get you interested in Scottish football, and look how good it is, and here's the nice production value about it, and we're going to tell you what's happening in Scottish football today. Why? That is what they should be doing. You look at Major League Soccer, their website, their social channels. I don't read about, well, I'm not in North America, admittedly, but I don't read what anyone else writes about MLS. I don't read what New York Times or anyone, don't know who writes about it. Couldn't tell you who does and who doesn't write about soccer in the States. Because Major League Soccer dictate the narrative for me as a viewer. I go to them and they tell me what's going on in Major League Soccer. Should be the same here. And I'm not saying kill media outlets.
No, but you might know this, because I think I know the answer, but you might be able to confirm. How many clubs in Scotland have got a marketing department?
I would say most in the Premiership will have one, but beyond that, there'll be one guy.
No, who does proper marketing department.
What, you mean
not
like
guy,
3, 4, 5 people?
No, someone whose full-time job is marketing.
Yeah. I'm trying to do a quick tally in my head, but yeah, I'd say probably most of the Premiership clubs now. I mean, some have just started to appoint, like Kilmarnock and Motherwell in the last 12 months appointed people who are devoted to it, or marketing and communications, it'd be like his combined job. But then that can be a thankless task as well, because is it really one person's job? And who are you marketing for? Are you marketing for your season ticket holders? Are you marketing for your part-time supporters? Are you marketing for the people who don't come? Are you marketing for the local community? Are you marketing for the wider world? The fan abroad, who are you marketing for? It's just a widespread.
Yeah, but that's the what the club has to determine what's going to maximise their
income. Of course.
But the league's job would then be one of the things if I ruled the world, it would be a benevolent dictatorship. It would be all lovely. One of the things I would do is go to STV. How can you get young people who are bombarded with the English Premiership every day get to start to be interested in Scottish football?
Make it, put it on a par.
Yeah, so first thing I might do is have a magazine style programme of an hour that's about the leagues below the Premier League.
Okay.
And whatever the cost is to make that, I would say to STV or BBC, this is the cost for this programme. So it's a break even for the league. And it doesn't cost that much. But a magazine-style programme that starts to look at every... There must be stories behind every club.
Of course there is.
You could... Instead of the Premier League, you've got enough clubs that you can run a whole season of stories. You know, sort of Gazzetta Italia style of... You're too young. Of the mid-1990s. But that type of programme that actually goes behind the scenes and explains about a player who's a postman and goes to a game and it tells you what his Saturday is like, or whatever the story is. Have that for below the Premier League for a start off.
Yeah. Well, this goes back to the argument of the league need to control the narrative, because the way it has been allowed to be dictated is it's Celtic and Rangers for what, 80-90% of all media coverage. Right, okay, well, if that's what newspapers and broadcasters and so on have decided shifts their titles or gets people to watch the programme, fine. You're probably not going to shift that mentality just by saying we're going to do this, because they don't want to lose newspaper sales. They don't want people turning off their TV sets or not coming on their website. Well, you go and do it yourself. If you're the SPFL, go and do it yourself. You generate that level of coverage, so when we get 5-10 years time, everyone, the balance might start to shift in a wider perspective. Go and tell the story about who was the guy, Frank McCowan, the Stranraer boy, who was the fireman at the club. You know, right, okay, papers picked that up because it was it was an inspirational story. And so on. I'm not saying there's stories on that level every week, but there are interesting people and interesting stories in every club and every community. We have 42 senior clubs in Scottish football, and I read about two every single day. And that's just because of the way the world has gone. That's what makes money. Well, so okay. Well, I'm speaking as someone who works in the editorial team at STV. Why would I change that? That's not what my readers want. They speak from a personal perspective, and also kind of with the STV hat on as well. I want to do it differently. I want to tell you about what's going on at Motherwell or St Johnstone or Kilmarnock. And we strive to try and not generate news, but we try and do analysis pieces or something that piques the wider interest.
So you are given the SPF, Neil Doncaster loses his job tomorrow and you're given it. Okay?
Could I just be head of marketing communications?
No.
Like that, right?
No, because actually Neil Doncaster's, and you're given real authority, so you don't have to go and ask Peter Lawwell for permission to train. You're given real authority, right? And you're in charge. You're a proper CEO of a proper business, okay? And it's called Scottish Football.
Yeah.
And I know.
I can feel the weight on my shoulders already.
Right. How do you turn it from 50 million a year from TV revenue to 54 million a year, which is Norway's back on track.
What sells the English Premier League? Is it one club? Is it two clubs? Is it four clubs? I would argue it's 20.
Mm-hmm.
All right, okay. A lot's weighted towards the superstars at the top. The whole package of the Premier League is about 20 clubs, or some owned by foreign owners, who all have at least one star on their team you can identify with. And the Premier League push that. The Premier League productions, and they push it around the world. It's about the Premier League, it's about the product as a whole. Where at the moment, well, SPFL don't do anything at the moment, apart from what they've got on their website and the events they'll do with the press in general. I would make it about the 12 clubs.
So how do you do that?
Like I said earlier on, controlling the narrative. Well, that's why I said, can I be head of marketing and communications?
No, but you're the chief executive telling the head of marketing what you want them to do.
Well, I would say give everyone equal weighting. Let's create stories about this league and let's tell every single story about this league. Let's make Motherwell as interesting as Rangers. Let's make Forfar as interesting as Aberdeen. And I'm sitting here thinking about that and thinking, that sounds a wee bit ridiculous. Let's keep it to the 12-team product at the top for starters. You put it on a level par.
Well, for a start, you stick with 12 teams as a start. because it's the whole product. You can't just then say, we're going to change the narrative, because the narrative's about your whole product.
Oh, Harry, it's ultimately down to the clubs, isn't it? Well, they want to say what they want to do.
You're the chief executive who's in a proper chief executive's role. So first up, would you stick with a 12-team top league?
It's funny because we discuss this all the time, and you can say 10, 12, 14, 16, whatever number you want to pluck out there. I am of a view, we find the natural number of how many clubs can sustain New World Order, where we have, this is how much money you need to be generating, this is how little debt you need to have, this is what your wage turnover needs to be. You need to create a model that's financially sustainable long term.
Mm-hmm.
How many clubs can hit that bar, and we work from there? And that's your professional clubs, whether that's 10, whether that's 16, whether that's 25, whatever, and we work from there. That's, people talk about league reconstruction all the time, and yeah, okay, we're talking about how do we sell this TV, or how do we engage the punter, then people would say, well, let's have a 16 team league. And I get that, let's try 16 teams, let's see what happens.
Well, one of the points I make is, we have big crowds, in the whole of August.
Mm-hmm.
Most clubs will have their best crowds in August and May.
Summer football is what you're moving to, aren't
it? No, not necessarily summer football.
Mm.
Because April, May time, you're getting to the end of the season, and August, you've just had a gap.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually because I've just eaten pizza while I was waiting for you, because I didn't have a lunch, and I quite like a Domino's pizza. I would be sick and fed up of Domino's pizza if I had one tomorrow, the next night, the next night, the night after. I actually think we have too many games.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I'd be quite happy to drop to a 16 team league playing each other twice. Getting back to your point, and we're doing that in 7 years' time.
Mm.
So just to let you know, everybody, this is the expected position in 6 years' time or 7 years' time, whatever it is. So you get 7 years to adjust your budget.
See, I like that, because we can be too reactionary. We're going to go, we're going to change. This is what ends up happening. We're moving to 16 teams in 12 months' time.
Yeah.
And you've got teams going, that's going down from 38 to 30 games. We're losing 4 home games a season here, potentially. And they go, but we're going to have this regionalised League Cup where you'll have home games against your local rivals.
And you're speaking to Peter as well.
but that's a gamble. You know, that whole idea, I think it's a nice idea, but is that really going to definitely make up the shortfall? I can see it as a creative idea to try and appease people.
Well, part of my thing is, in terms of reducing the number of games, is the average attendance at Rugby Park for a Celtic Kilmarnock game has dropped down.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing special about Celtic coming to town.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if Celtic came to town once a season, I'm not saying you'll go from 6,000 to 12,000, but you might go from 6,000 to 9,000. But you've also just reduced by 50% the number of stewards, the amount of policing, and various other costs. So you might actually find the attendance goes up a bit for the one game, not sufficient to give you all the money, but your costs will also come back a bit, and you might actually hit an equilibrium where the clamour last season when Celtic got Hearts in the cup, because we're not going to Tynecastle this season. was much higher. Celtic fans do like going to Tynecastle because but it was higher than the clamour to go to when we played in twice, and we're going to play them twice next season and twice the next season.
Of course.
So there's a part of me thinks a reduction to 16, you may actually get slightly better crowds on a per game basis because of that thing of give me Domino's pizza every night in the meeting and get fed up with it.
It's about creating, it's about variety, but it's also about meaningful games. I sound like Neil Doncaster here again, but you've got to create a reason for people who want to go to games, and I think this is part of the wider discussion about Scottish football at the moment. Why should people go to games? We have the English Premier League on our doorstep. You can pretty much see every single game, and we can see Spanish football, and we can see all that. So I'm right, okay, so I can watch any football I want, the telly when I want. So why should I go? You have games played. We don't have four seasons here spread out normally, but we play games on New Year's Day, Christmas time, because that's the accepted thing. People like that. We've always done it that way. You know, people quite like it.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. People like that. We charge £20 or whatever to get into a match, and you turn up and you're there for 90 minutes and right, bugger off, we'll see you in 2 weeks' time. It's about changing mindsets and about changing, making Scottish football meaningful. And when you say meaningful, people think, we need to have split the league four ways and then three ways and then eight ways to create. But no, it's not. Making Scottish football meaningful is not necessary. It doesn't always have to come back to the product on the park. It's a bit meaningful as a wider experience. Why would I want to go to Almondvale to see Livingston play when we're 7th, 8th in the league and it's all a bit dull? Well, because I go and I see my pals and I do this for 2 hours before the game, and there's this facility and there's this interesting thing happening, and you create a buzz around it because during the week I'm speaking to this guy, I'm doing that, and I'm listening to this podcast, I'm watching this video and so on. When we talk about making Scottish football meaningful, it extends far more beyond games. It's about doing something to ram it down people's throats that this means something. Well, the English Premier League did. When we talk about, I must hear conversations every day about the English Premier League, and I must count on one hand how many of the games I saw last year, but I could tell you absolutely everything about it. I was in a damn sight lot more Scottish games, and I couldn't tell you the same level of stuff because it's not rammed down my throat. I have to go looking for it. I have to have such a passionate interest to go and dig things out for myself.
And you rightly pointed out that you believe that the onus is on the football authorities to create a narrative that's bigger than a Celtic Rangers narrative.
Oh, of course.
But they need a platform for that narrative to go on. And if I'm... So Radio Scotland, to talk about a semi-competitor here, Radio Scotland, in general, Monday to Friday, for a large chunk of last year, talked about Scottish football.
Mm-hmm.
There was one team who, for me, for most football fans I know of different clubs, were not that relevant because they were a sideshow of their own. And they weren't relevant to everybody else. But all of a sudden, it's as if an editorial decision was taken in the BBC round about March time that 75% of every single Monday to Friday sports sound was going to be about that team, that basket case team. And the only rationale I can come up with was because the listening figures were better when they talked about them. So how do you, if you're in the league, you can have all the narrative you want, but how do you stop?
I don't need the numbers.
How do you stop STV or BBC saying, very good, but we are just going to talk about Rangers tonight?
No, they do what they want, and that's fine. I'm not going to turn up as the chief executive of the SPFL and sit in a meeting with STV and go, by the way, you're going to stop talking about Celtic and Rangers as much as you are. You're going to talk about Motherwell and Kilmarnock a lot more. Well, obviously, that's not going to happen. But let them carry on. Of course, because it's not going to change, because that's what shifts papers, that's what makes people go on websites, switch TVs on. You change your mindset over a long period of time. If I am the SPFL, I don't rely on the numbers. I don't need 2 million people coming to my website. I don't need to write about Celtic and Rangers every day. I don't need to appease the audience. I'm going to write for everyone. I'm going to create this idea that the Scottish Professional Football League, or the Premiership, which I would home in on, is about all of this. There's 12 clubs playing in this league, by the way. Not just one, not just two. And hopefully, gradually over time, be able to adjust the mindset that Motherwell and St Johnstone are not necessarily on the same level as Celtic and Rangers, but they're talked about in the same breath.
So what would you do to make that event around every game that makes people turn up to the Motherwell St Johnson game?
So actually getting people to games?
How do you get people through the turnstiles?
How long have you got? Okay. From a, let's talk from a media point of view, since it's supposed to field of expertise. It's about generating a buzz. And hopefully you've built that buzz over a number of years that suddenly this game always means something. It's got Motherwell St Johnson, God, what a hard sell.
That's exactly why I picked Motherwell St Johnson. Who cares about that?
Give it something. You must be able to find some story in Motherwell St Johnson. Let's say it's a like Monday, we've got a, you just create a buzz around it. You talk about former players and we create a, you know, we talk about rivalry, or we talk about alright, this Motherwell players play for St Johnson, build it up that way, or we come up with ideas about Motherwell against St Johnson head to head and all these great games. We put great video content out there. He was 5 great goals scored when Motherwell played St Johnson. Isn't this a good game? The goals are scored like this in this game, or these incidents happen, or they've got these great players, or these. So that's the generating a buzz during the week, and you hear from the managers and you get behind the scenes content related to it as well. You're in training, you're speaking to the manager, you're speaking to players every day, you're doing something interesting, you're generating good engaging content. I, as a spectator, feel part of that. Right, well, what's happening at Motherwell St Johnson this week? I get to have a say. I'm made to feel relevant, I'm made to feel important by my club or the opposition club and so on. So that's the media side of things. Coming up with really good content ideas, far better than I've managed to come up with in a top of my head in 30 seconds.
Yeah. You've not mentioned Facebook.
Getting to that. And then there's an engagement side of things and the match day experience. Going to any game should be, if you're taking the football out of it, going to any game should be a pleasurable experience. Whether I'm going to Motherwell St Johnson, whether I'm going to Motherwell against Hamilton, Motherwell against Celtic, Motherwell against Juventus in Europe, whatever the game is, I should be passionate and looking forward to going to that. I'm not going to endure a game for 90 minutes because I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Motherwell fan. I'm going because I'm there with my pals, and I can go along at 12 o'clock and we can sit in the bar and we can watch football that's on, or and then we can take the kids and then go and play the PlayStations or face paint. And there's actual, and that's very simplistic. I think some clubs have tried that, and it's like that's like level one match day experience. And it's about engagement after that. It's about creating things that, because you can only paint kids' faces so many times a season. It's about having experiences, having, I think St. Mirren have done this great thing with their local bands, so that gets certain demographic along and interested in that. You're having, I don't know, experiences that you're doing different times that excite people and make it about a day out at the football. And then the football itself is secondary. And the football can never be secondary necessarily, because
I know what you mean in terms of, for those people who only want to turn up and watch the game.
Well, we're not taking that away from them, yeah.
Yeah, they turn up and watch the game. For the added people, the football is secondary because it's the whole experience that they're enjoying. So, being able to have a pint at a game. I don't drink, but that's a big thing for me.
I've just thought of an example in my head, and this is probably the worst thing in the world, but I may come out with it anyway. I don't think my wife goes to the shops because she's looking forward to buying a dress. You know, that's the end game. Mm-hmm. It's the experience of going to shops and trying so many things on and seeing all the nice things or otherwise that are out there, and then being in the buzz of people and so on. It's about the whole thing rather than the conclusion.
Uh-huh, yeah. It's not about the journey.
Oh dear. You know, it's not about what's happening at the end of it all when you get to the tower. It's about everything that goes alongside
it.
It's
the adventure.
Of course. And it's the experience. Believe me, my wife keeps going back to the shops. She keeps going back.
There's almost, well, put it in.
Absolutely terrible.
But I understand what you mean, in that when I was young, you would go to buy a record. You would go to buy an LP, and you go into town, and you go into Virgin and Union Street, which could be a bit scary at times because there was, you know, punks and all sorts of people in there when you're young. And then all the way home on the train, you're reading the album sleeve. Mm-hmm. And actually, when you get home and play the record, some songs you've already heard on the radio, that's why you bought it, and you play it over and over again. But actually, you then want to go back in.
You're
and
going
buy
next
the next
week,
album.
You? Yeah.
And so how do you get? I mean, one of the things I would love, it's a money thing. I'd love every SPL ground to have a big screen minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And every goal, in terms of why going to the game is better than not going to the game.
Yeah.
Every single goal that's scored in Scotland, it involves tearing up the TV contracts and starting again. But every single goal that's scored in all the games kicking off at the same time, every goal that's scored gets shown on the big screen as it happens. Not just the goal flash, but the actual goal when you're at a game. The principle of trying to capture the, when you're watching a Champions League night,
yep,
at home on the telly, yeah, you press, screen, yeah, and you press the red button and you've got all eight games on at exactly the same time, and you decide to watch one game and you've missed the goal on the game that you've been watching for 20 minutes that was boring. And, but the principle of when you're there, you're getting what somebody else has not got, the sky red button.
Yeah, you're getting something unique to that experience. It's interesting because I think certain generations, perhaps my generation, generations younger, going to the football is still roughly what it was for our fathers and our grandfathers. But we, in our day-to-day lives, we do not live in a world that, which was similar to our fathers and our grandfathers, and especially technologically, we live in a world where everything's at our fingertips. Mm-hmm. But football, the stadium experience hasn't evolved with that.
No.
So that's what your ideas.
You sit down instead of standing up when I was young.
Yeah.
Young people today sit down. But they've had sitting down for 20 years. So they're used to it. It's a given that they get to sit down at football.
Yeah, but I mean,
it's not fantastically. You know, in our last podcast with Graham Spears with St. Anthony's, and Anthony was saying, I don't want to sit stand anymore. And the safe stand is coming in because some people want to stand at a game. Mm. And it's a different standing experience than when I had. I went to the Celtic Notts Forest game at Celtic Park, where we'd drawn 0-0 down there, and then we lost to Celtic Park. I saw nothing of that game.
Mm-hmm.
I was standing in the Rangers end and I saw hee-haw. I'd be much better at, this is the bit that young people don't understand about standing at football, which will be different for them, because they, in safe standing at Celtic Park, they'll be standing in an inclined stadium that's been built to give you a view of the ground.
Yeah.
I saw nothing of that game because I was 11 and I was too small and the stadium was overfull. They'll not be experiencing that. But the principle of going and going to the game and you'll just be thankful that we've got a roof over your head mentality is what exists in Scottish football to me.
I mean, I even think of myself, I mean, my attention span, this is probably because of iPhones and Twitter, which my Twitter, because I follow too many people, it spins at 100 rates, 100 tweets a second.
You shouldn't follow more than about 150 people.
Okay, I better get busy tonight then.
No, just as an aside, I think if you follow more than that, you're actually following nobody.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of stuff gets lost, but I think it's attention span. I mean, years ago I'd sit at a football match and your attention span's there for 90 minutes, and I go these days and I'll reach for my phone and I'll see what other, and I'll see what other scores are and what other people are saying from other games, and depending, well, doesn't happen in Scottish football, but you know, if it's an English game you're at, you're probably getting a vine of a goal from another game, you know, I have it at my fingertips. So I would say that a lot of young football fans now, they never really get out of the 5-6 year old mentality of they don't have the attention span to watch a football game for 90 minutes. Their attention is going to be diverted.
Not to sound like an old fogey, but young people experience life through, even when they're at an event.
Yeah.
They're so busy wanting to film it through their phone.
Concerts now as well.
That they actually are looking at the event through their phone. They're apparently watching it on electronic media, and yet, so this is my point about, I'd love big screens.
Yeah, well, so it takes a bit around to your idea. Yeah.
Everybody listening to this, most people listening to this will know I go to cricket once a year. I'll go to a one day international, whatever. So two things about that, your point about the vine. 2 years, 3 years ago, I was at Old Trafford at the cricket when England played, was it Germany, when Lampard had the shot?
2010, yeah, yeah.
2000, was that 2010?
Yeah, I know.
Oh, good God. 5 years ago, I was at the cricket when England were playing Germany and Lampard had the shot that hit the bar, bounced down over the line and out. At the cricket, I watched on my phone the replay of that. I read it on Twitter, watched the replay of it to find out that the ball was over the line within 2-3 minutes of the event happening in real life. If I'm at the cricket now, they will stick up messages, and it happened at the Commonwealth Games as well, and they do it, to be fair, they tried to do it to Hampden, it's just Hampden's such a poor stadium, you know, they'll have a hashtag and people can put up selfies and all the other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's, my point would be, see if that's not for you, fine.
Yeah.
It's not getting in your way of enjoying the game.
Of course.
But for the people that it is for, that enhances their experience. I would just go one further and the hand and then stops. I would have that going on through the game and I'd have the referees mic'd up, like you get in American football. So the Inverness situation, you just had the referee saying,
well, you hear what's going on at the time.
Given, or even if the referee transmits it back to the fourth official and the fourth official broadcasts it.
The whole point of all of this is that people my age and younger, people who have adopted technology, come to expect things within seconds. Doesn't matter about the quality of it. People hold up phones to their TVs and Vine goals or Snapchat them or whatever. Yeah. Oh yeah. That's what we come to expect now. But if you're going to a Scottish football match, you probably say this about a lot of football matches around the world, in fairness. So it's not a direct criticism of Scottish football, but you're asking me as new CEO of the Scottish Professional Football League, you have the problem of the TV contracts. And it all comes back to that, where they're like, well, we can't put goals on our website from Saturday 3 o'clock games until 6 o'clock on a Sunday. That's the UK embargo for to protect the primary rights holders, Sky.
Is that when you could do a highlights programme as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, that's the first time you could do a highlights programme as well. Yeah.
Why do you do a highlights programme at 6:05 on a Sunday?
Why not?
Because you know what? More people are awake and not in bed at 6:05 on a Sunday than they are at 10:30 through to 11:30 on a Sunday night.
TV scheduling, in my limited experience, I've found is perhaps one of the problems. You know, there are so many peak programmes now we come to associate with any day of the week that to try and disrupt.
4 o'clock to 7 o'clock, it's 4 o'clock to 7:30 on a Sunday's dead time. And you know, that's why Antiques Roadshow was on at that time and Last of Summer Wine used to be on. Nobody watches television at that time of night.
A lot, you remember as well, a lot of people don't.
What being you can shift
appointment to view TV's waning. I mean I can't think of the last programme I actually sat down and watched at the time it was on. You know, I now record things and watch them back, or they're on TV on demand services.
But that's why I don't get STV, because the one thing that people do watch that you can drive advertisers to is live sport. The one thing people can't,
yeah, that is the exception to the rule. Yeah.
The one thing people can't watch on delay is live sport. It's the reason why live sports rights are so astronomical, because it's the one thing that advertising can get guaranteed eyes and guaranteed times of the day. And Sky are paying such a pittance for Scottish football, I can't. And the BBC pay such a pittance for Scottish Cup or and the League Cup. I don't believe that STV couldn't outbid one of them on one of those TV deals.
Unfortunately, I don't. I'm not the person that makes, you know, I genuinely don't know what the, how it's viewed, how sport is viewed in that sense, in terms of going for rights. I mean, I've said it countless times. People come to me on Twitter all the time and they'll say, oh, why are you not doing this? Why are you not doing that? I'm like, well, it's not me. You know, if it was me and an unlimited pot of cash, I would be doing that, but all I can say is, from an editorial point of view, what we try and do is make the most of what we've got. And any time, and we continue to push and say, well, we think this would be good, we think that would be good. And we work with what we've got, and we don't try and make the best of what we've got. We're trying to go above and beyond that. But I completely agree with you about live sport. I mean, it's obvious. We look at the money that BT paid for the Champions League and Europa League rights. And the Scottish football is pitched at such a level which is ridiculously lower than any of those numbers. We can never dream to achieve probably the English Premier League deal from 10-15 years ago, such as the level we're at. I don't know what those figures were. I could be completely wrong there. It's about making financial sense out of Scottish football, and it takes us back round, doesn't it? It takes us back round to the initial argument. Well, why?
Being the rules, man, the BT Sport thing. Have BT Sport bought the Scottish, did BT Sport bid for the Scottish TV rights, or did the Scottish TV rights fall with what BT Sport
for European football?
For European football, because nobody else bid for
far them. As far as I'm aware, certainly for the last Sky/ITV deal, or maybe even the one before that, I'm sure I spoke to UEFA and they had said there is a Scottish package that can be purchased, but it's not been taken up. Therefore, it's clubbed into a British deal, which is then taken to the marketplace.
Which we then don't, when I say we, Celtic then don't get their share of what they would get if it was a Scottish deal.
Yeah, but then how the market pool, which is the TV revenues, is calculated is based on so many, like how you arrive at that end figure is based on so many things about how much money that club generates in its own marketplace in terms of a deal and how much money it generates in other marketplaces. So it's impossible, unfortunately, but maybe someone somewhere can forecast it. Being in the UK market pool, the Scottish club gets a guaranteed 10% of the UK market pool. Mm-hmm. Can we legitimately say that if the Scottish deal was sold to a Sky STV consortium or whatever for, and which wouldn't be a competitive marketplace, there would not be a competitive marketplace for a Scottish Champions League deal or Europa League deal because there's not enough competitors with the cash to do it. So the figure would probably be quite low. I would argue Celtic actually, especially in the current light of how much that deal has been ramped up, Celtic would do far better out of a guaranteed 10% of UK market pool. I mean, English Premier League's, you know, achieved the biggest sports right deal in the world. Mm-hmm. It's not bad to be in bed with those clubs in a European deal, is it? Because you're suddenly... It's like the Celtic dream of being in the English Premier League and benefiting from those rights. Well, here's the light version. You're in that.
But there's more to it than that, because there's also the additional revenues you can generate by being on television. And what happens is we get bought into the Sky deal, and then we get stuck.
You don't get shown. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, perhaps BT are going to change that. I mean, BT have committed to showing.
The other thing I would argue is 12% of Sky subscribers are in Scotland.
So 10% is not bad then, is it?
No, it's 2% light. I don't know what BT's position is, but then that's also the then part of my bugbear of the European Commission. I was having this conversation with someone earlier today. It used to cost you X to watch football on television, and the European Commission came along and said that's unfair because Sky have got a monopoly. Mm. And that means there's no competitor to Sky, because Sky can do whatever they want to the prices, and that's not fair to the consumer. So you cannot sell your rights to one entity, you must sell it to two. Mm-hmm. But Sky are already so far up there that any competitor came in, Setanta, ESPN, did it on I'm not saying there was a cartel, but it felt like a cartel. Mm-hmm. It felt like a carve-up. Parking the BT winning the Champions League rights, it felt like a carve-up of, you take those packages and we'll take these packages. So now, as someone who no longer goes to Celtic away games and only ever watches Celtic home games, I now, if I want to watch Celtic on the television away from home, have to pay double what I did before the European Commission decided, in my best interests, to say that there had to be two people bidding for it. And my great bugbear of that is, the two people bidding, I can't believe, getting back to it, it's so low I can't believe that STV or BBC didn't bid for one of the lesser rights.
Mm. Well, perhaps they did. I genuinely don't know. Perhaps they did. Perhaps they were priced out of it. STV or BBC. Look, BBC Alba are in there.
Yeah, so I can't believe actually that BBC, there's a thing for you, Mr. STV. Not you personally. BBC Alba are in there.
Yeah.
So it couldn't have cost that much to get the package that BBC Alba got for Championship. Create a magazine programme around what they do, as they've done at halftime.
They do great halftime stuff, yeah.
It's not beyond the wit of STV to do something slightly bigger and better, I wouldn't have thought. Getting back to the league's responsible, the Football Authority's responsible, maybe you take a hit on the League Cup,
mm-hmm.
and you insist that the League Cup gets a decent TV contract from one of STV or BBC. Getting back to and if neither of them fulfill your production requirements, you actually say, I tell you what we'll do, we'll package it up and give you for cost price, provided you stick it on at these times.
What I don't know is if there's anyone at the SPFL who's had the nous to hold such a conversation. I genuinely don't know if these conversations have been had, whether it's even been thought of. You'd like to think so, wouldn't you? But I honestly don't know. And it kind of, like you say, it takes it all back to being the onus on the SPFL. What do they do to actively promote their game, or do they just take the best amount of cash that comes along and leave it up to the broadcaster?
As fans, I've noticed online, I've started to become a bit more sophisticated of understanding that a channel sitting on the Sky platform is going to cost a fortune, I think. Celtic TV being on the Sky platform costs Celtic £1 million a year, something like that. More and more people are talking about the type of channel that you'll get on Apple TV for.
Yeah, a Netflix style model, yeah.
Some sort of streaming. As a new media man, do you think that would work?
I had a conversation with someone who knows about these things at STV, and I can't remember. I've been speaking to a few folk on Twitter about it. I got quite passionate about the idea, and I was a bit shot down on it. I can't really remember the ins and outs conversation. It was because obviously the overheads you would think would be lower because you're not paying for a platform. You're not on Sky EPG. You're not even paying whatever transmission costs. I think what it all boils down to is the guarantee of having the subscribers to sustain it. I mean, Rod Petrie went for the big club TV model before the sudden collapse and re-signing of the Sky deal in 2011-12. And they had, I mean, I've seen documents, and they had projected so many thousand subscribers. I mean, so we're talking six-figure subscribers over a five-year period, and getting to these levels that would generate this amount of cash for clubs. And that was then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, broadband technology and 4G and on our phones has evolved incredibly since then. So I think technologically, it's the ability is there at least to have a platform for it. The other consideration would be being able to create the content for it in a technological sense as well, or a production sense. And also there is the consumer side of things, going back to the numbers, how many people would actually pay £5, £10, £15 a month for it? I'm a strong believer people would. But I think 50% of that is me just being pickhead and thinking, well, I would. And the other 50% is people, a very small number of people on Twitter, which always tends to be the noisiest people on Twitter. You suddenly think it's a thousand folk talking to you.
It's fine.
Keep telling me it's the greatest thing as well. So, yeah, I do think it is.
Well, you know the numbers. I like to think that if somebody had a well-produced programme about Scottish football that actually had... Now, the biggest problem is, how do you get a Gary Neville-type person to analyse tactics and talk about those types of things in a game? Because I've never heard a Scottish-based pundit have that. I mean, I know one thing that if you ever did do something, do not ever get an existing player as a pundit on, because you might as well get my dog. Because when's he ever going to say, when's a current player going to say, yep, he took a blatant dive there?
Yeah, no, I can understand that.
Particularly when they then get the player on to talk about his own team, where there's a dubious penalty decision. So, Grant, what do you think of that when it's patently a dive of Andy Coyle's been, you know, you're playing fives and Andy's taking a dive. You're going to say, yeah, he dives all the time, doesn't train. No. So what's the point in having that one? But you know the numbers of what gets more hits to your site. A tabloidy style story of the latest Rangers implosion, or a technical conversation about Ron and I are talking about the minds, getting the players and the learning mindset of players.
Yeah, probably a bad example actually, because that was really popular. I get what you mean. I loved that bit. I mean, Ronnie Dyla's lecture in Norway on how he manages people.
Yeah,
incredible. I mean, it's really inspiring if it's anyone who wants to be in management.
But the only thing that the only possibility I think Warburton might be a success at Rangers is the quote from Warburton of Joe Wallace taught him everything he needed to know about how not to manage football players and how not to manage people. So there's a possibility he may be that type of person. But anyway, you get my point.
Yeah.
Quality over tabloid.
But I'm a strong believer in that as well. I mean, I would say in STV, Andy Coyle, myself, Scott McClyman, Tom Watt, who was with us as well, and other people who have been involved down the years on the online and the digital side of things, we were given the free rein to come up with ideas and run with it. And we're given quite a lot of leeway. I mean, you talk about doing a programme like that, the disappointing thing for me was, and it was online only, and it was 2 years ago, maybe the world's changed that much since then, we did a programme. I bet you couldn't tell me the name of it right now.
No.
That's, and the amount of hours that went into that and the amount of expertise and passionate football people talking about me sitting there telling you why a referee was right or wrong and telling you the rules and showing incidents over and over, which would only really do good traffic if, I think one was, did Anthony Stokes dive in the box or something like that, and suddenly you're getting...
Should have turned it into a podcast as well.
Perhaps we should have, then you would have listened. Yeah, people will click on the sensational thing, but we weren't geared towards that. We just wanted to provide a level of analysis on anything, and we did tactics. Scott McClymont would talk about how Kilmarnock would defend a set piece, or and Tom would talk about how Aberdeen did a, you know, and so we did these things, but we had,
I didn't even know it was on.
Well, and it wasn't even appointment to view. It was, you could watch it now whenever the hell you wanted. We would film it on a Monday. We did it on a Friday as well. We did Friday previews, which, I mean, people are not going to sit down and watch. I think in hindsight, people weren't going to sit down and watch a 2 minute of two guys talking about a game necessarily. But we turned that around and we homed in on, well, here's how Aberdeen are going to win their game against Motherwell, and here's Kilmarnock's weak point for their game against Celtic. So we tried to make it more interesting that way, and that provide, again, a level of analysis. It wasn't just your bog standard two guys sitting saying a lot of cliched nonsense. It was proper level of analysis. And even someone as engaged as you on social media can't sit here and tell me what the name of that was. I'm sorry to make you feel embarrassed.
No, I'm not feeling embarrassed. Well, because, you know, I would then say it's a bit like on the internet, everybody talks about the mainstream media is finished. That's nonsense. Because actually, for a story to become a real story, it's actually the thing that bugs me about the Daily Record, and like, because despite what we all say, for a story to actually then become a real story, take legs and have consequences,
it needs to be picked up by a major outlet.
It does actually need to be properly broadcast, which is either newspapers or television. It still needs to be on those two mediums. Wholly online content, Netflix works because it's not wholly online content.
Yeah, because people watch on TV.
I wouldn't get wife to watch a television program that was only on the iPad. Yeah. She might watch it on the iPad, but she wouldn't start watching something. It would need to be on the television.
And admittedly, it was I used to watch it back on the TV, but I was wiring up my laptop to the TV. Again, it was different times. I mean, I don't have a smart TV. I have a PlayStation plugged into a TV. I can watch STV player on or whatever. I mean, technology's changed.
Two years' time, I can stream a game and bounce onto my television, and the picture quality. I mean, I remember watching Celtic played Inverness in a game, and it was one of the first games BT Sport had, or one of the last, or ESPN had it, or maybe it was ESPN. It was like a Minecraft version of a TV program. You know, everything was just all boxy and couldn't make out on the tiny square the size of, you know, your phone on the computer screen. Now I'll stream a game and bounce on to my telly, and it's,
yeah.
So these things have moved on.
No, absolutely they have. And I wouldn't rule out necessarily in the new season a rethink from us about, okay, this was a highly polished, I mean, it started out as three guys chatting about football, then we would wing it. And it became this highly polished production that would not have looked out of place on television at all. And it would take three, four guys, take up their whole day on a Monday to the extent where we're doing nothing else. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's going to impact what your key offering is. So I think there's clearly a market for it, and I don't mean hundreds of thousands of people. I just mean there's people who want it. It's not going to be people that are going to suddenly double and treble the website traffic overnight, but it's creating a level of analysis and creating a narrative that people are interested in. If you keep plugging long term enough, it creates
that. Maybe if you do that, maybe BBC move away from two cardboard cutouts and a crap set of highlights packages.
Well, it's interesting because I don't think we would ever go back to a highly polished production as it stands, unless STV turned around to me tomorrow and said, "Graham, we want you to do. We're going to start doing a highlight show on the TV again, the magazine show, and here's X amount of money, and you know, it'll be a big all singing, all dancing thing." Great. I think in what we do at the moment, what resource we work with, I think the way the digital sphere is, it's going to be about quite unpolished content. It's, again, taking back to what I was saying about the guy holding up the yeah. phone to the TV to Vine the Go. People just want accessible content.
Yeah, but I think people want two things. I think people want the instant content, but I think people also want, I think
you want something polished, I guess.
Something polished reflect. So one of my other bugbears about the coverage of Scottish football, people under the age, well, do you know this? Do you know why? You know the really crap thing where they say, that's on every Christmas, only an excuse, right? When they tell the same jokes they told last year, and they, you know. Well, for a start, who under the age of 30 recognises Frank McAvaney and Dennis Law, apart from the fact that they are caricatures of, they wouldn't actually know that they are real human beings. Anyway, that's by the way. Do you know why it's called Only an Excuse?
No.
Out of the Only a Game documentary that the BBC did, that was narrated by William McIlvany, that was absolutely fantastic in 1986, and it was 86, because the Only an Excuse was the televisual history of Scottish football up to 1986. It was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Narrated by McIlvany, I don't know if it, and I think Roddy Forsyth was one of the writers of it, and it stopped with Graham Souness's arrival at Rangers, right? What an amazing transformation in Scottish football in that 30-year window.
Sure.
Who has done the top notch? And bearing in mind, it's a televisual history of Scottish football, which is effectively 20 years, because you've only had television for 20 years prior to 86.
Yep.
You've now got 30 years of television since then. You've got plus the volume of television. Where, if you're wanting to do your poor quality but it's instant after the game stuff, and it might actually have a raw passion about it because it's straight after games that maybe STV do a review show, and it would involve changing the TV rights package, but maybe you actually just do from 6 to 7 a much rawer programme that actually is not a highlights package. It's just goals.
And
a bit of your chat, but also accompany that with, I would absolutely love, go on YouTube, go and look up Only a Game.
Right.
It's brilliant. I mean, the original Only an Excuses, the ones that were funny 30 years ago, they're actually done in the, I think it's Tony Roper does the William McAvaney voice of them. That's why it's called Only Excuses.
Yeah.
So only, I think STV, that's what frustrates me about STV. You're actually doing neither. You're neither doing the cheap and cheerful ready comp the BBC. Actually, BBC are in a halfway house. It's not even cheap and cheerful, it's just bish. Do a cheap and cheerful 6-7, these are the goals, and a bit of the chat with two guys that you don't spend all Sunday preparing, that you might half cobble together as you're watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knows it's a bit funny. Maybe you put it on STV Glasgow and STV Edinburgh instead because it's so rough and ready. But you do at 10:30 at night the equivalent of what Only a Game was. Something that's a real quality. It's a sales product for Scottish football. This is our story.
Yeah,
this is fantastic.
It has to be stepping stones. I think we went into heavy last time where we suddenly rushed up to this high value production in the hope that maybe we might catch someone's eye and suddenly we would have this show on STV, for example. And what we have now is a void of, well, we've not done anything now. So when I talk about rough and ready content, it's just about, well, we know we have the guys and girls in that team who can provide a level of analysis that's not seen anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on a level with your average punter, because we are average punters. And I think
your bosses are selling their staff short. You have a quality of, I would say there's two, maybe three people across the BBC who talk like football fans. Right, that's my perception as an outsider, you don't need to comment. And you guys have an online team of people who appear to be football fans.
But we've got a platform.
and they're not giving you the platform.
Our platform is it? We've built a platform, even though it's not on the big telly.
No, but that's it. That's where they're selling you short. Because look at it. Major sport. This is the thing that gets me about STV and BBC. Major sport, as we've just discussed, is the only thing that gets eyeballs. Live sport is the only thing that gets eyeballs on the television, as and when this appointment TV. It is the only thing in Coronation Street. They're the only things, right?
Mm-hmm.
People watch them when they're on, and they have to watch them when they're on. And throughout the rest of the world, TV broadcasters are falling over themselves for content.
Mm-hmm.
We know that Scotland is second only to Cyprus in the world for per capita watching and involvement in football.
Mm-hmm.
So in each sport, and you have the best per capita in the world, in countries with a population above 1.5 million, you have the best per capita potential audience, and not one broadcaster in Scotland decided to bid for European football.
I mean, European football is a different marketplace. I think it's easier to take it back to did they bid for Scotland?
And they're not bidding for Scottish football.
Well, we don't
on,
know.
On an achievable level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's achievable because Sky's bidding so low. And you could actually have a quid pro quo that I would have the conversation with Neil Doncaster if I'm a broadcaster. I'll pay £3 million less than Sky, but I will give you such a fantastic product, as happened in Rugby League.
Mm-hmm.
When they were going for a league sponsor and they picked the lower bid because Eddie Stobart's lorries said, we will put pictures of rugby league players on every one of our lorries, and they will take your league from being a northwest of England with a bit round hull league game. We will take it from John O'Groats to Land's End because that's where our lorries
go. It's not just about cash.
And they said that's a smarter move to have the cheaper product but the national coverage.
Well, we have to remember Scottish football supposedly has been living in existence for the last 4 or 5 years, where they desperately need the cash. And a lot of decisions, I don't think it's unfair to say, have been short term. Get that cash in the door to ensure our very survival on the business models that we are existing on in the moment. Now, you talked earlier on about, we have a 16 team league and we give them 7 years to hit it. Right, okay, that's sustainable enough and that's achievable enough. But there was all these threats of, and I'm going to use the A word, Armageddon and social unrest and all this nonsense that went on.
The guy who used that should have been fired the next day. But any other business he would have been. If you went on STV and said, if the BBC doesn't exist, we go bust.
And amongst all the misinformed statements, there was still scaremongering in terms of the figures that were being presented to the clubs of what was happening to TV deals overnight if Rangers were in the third division or first division or kept in the SPL. There was still a reality there of an uncertainty.
Oh, and you have to pay the bills.
Yeah.
I get it.
So the reason Scottish football finds itself in this situation, and by the way, if anyone's going to quote me on Twitter on this, the 140 character version of this is not Scottish football finds itself where it is because Rangers came back in the third division. No, it's not it. Rangers are not it. The reason Scottish football has had a hand-to-mouth existence is not because of Rangers going bust, but it's a symptom. It's a massive symptom.
I would argue Rangers, Scottish football lived a hand-to-mouth existence because of Rangers.
Well, yeah, okay.
I said because of David Murray.
Yeah, yeah, okay. The people trying to compete. Well,
the argument I continually had with, and I'm going to call St Anthony out on our side of the podcast last week with Graham Spears, and asked Graham Spears, what was it that he saw that the rest of us didn't? Well, that's nonsense, because I used to be on our podcast every week saying speculate to accumulate is the business economics of a bonkers person. Because what we were doing was everybody speculated to accumulate. So what actually the fans were asking everybody to do was speculate to accumulate. And then everybody speculated to accumulate. And so it was just this. I think the best thing that's happened to Scottish football in the last 30 years was Rangers going bust.
In what way? Because suddenly we had a different type of competitiveness.
Yes.
And clubs had to suddenly find a way to redress their balance sheets.
Correct. It made everybody stop. What happened was, if you look at Aberdeen, Aberdeen spent four seasons trying to compete with Rangers from about 88 to 92. And spent the next 23 years dealing with the consequences of 4 years of trying. Mm-hmm. They paid £1 million for players. Mm-hmm. They spent 23 years dealing with the consequences of 4 years of speculative accumulating nonsense. However, and Celtic spent every year business planning to be ahead of Rangers this year. And they'll deal with the following year, the year after.
Mm.
And the best thing that happened for everybody, in some ways, I'm sure if I was running a club, I would not have liked to have been faced with those consequences. But the best thing that it made everybody do, so Celtic have had to say, do you know what? They're such a basket case. They're like bouncing around the padded cell and we've no idea when they're going to come out. So we actually have to make a 5-year plan of how we're going to run our business, whether they're here or not.
Well, it's utterly ludicrous, though.
That you appear to have that mentality at Hearts.
Yeah, of course.
Come on, then.
Oh, it's created something. Of course it has, but it's absolutely ludicrous that Scottish football came to that point that it required the demise of one of its biggest clubs to suddenly make everyone try and get a bit realistic about it all. I would argue there were some clubs that had the foresight to try and redress the balance. I mean, we had so many administrations in the mid-noughties,
mm-hmm.
you know, Motherwell, Livingston, Dundee, and so on. And some clubs have started to have the foresight after that. But it's absolutely ludicrous. And someone needs to be made accountable at a higher level that it required the Rangers situation for the realism to really set in. And not the fantasy realism that was painted by the SPL at the time of what would happen to clubs. Six clubs would disappear overnight. I'm sure it was another quote from someone.
It's St. Mirren,
yes. St. Mirren,
yeah.
So not the fantasy realism, but it's absolutely ludicrous that it took that. Where was the business acumen and foresight that Scottish football could never continue to exist in that form? And it was interesting in a way that, what was it, I was reading, I was in the Swiss Rambles thing on Celtic when I was on holiday as well.
Yeah.
And this is a terrible paraphrasing, so forgive me, but it was something like the chairman's statement every year was, oh, we're spending the money to attract the, you know, our business plan is to spend the money to try and attract the best players in the environment we operate in, so essentially to win the league and qualify for Europe.
Yeah.
And now it's tailored as, oh, we try our best to do this within the financial constraints of the club. That's always what it should have been. God, that's business, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's just ludicrous. And I know that's a football thing. I know common sense, business sense can go out the window with football, but how collectively did we not have the foresight that Scottish football needed to be at a different place, even if that hadn't happened at Rangers?
And that's where my frustration at the likes of the Daily Record, where, you know, Fergus McGann gets compared with Saddam Hussein, yet nobody has ever called out David Murray for the financial vandalism he wrought in Scottish football, because what he did was, for a brief window, everybody tried to compete with Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
Motherwell did it. Everybody did it. And the consequence of that was, for 2 or 3 years, they spent next season's money.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like going to your boss and asking for an advance on next month's wages. That's fine in the current month. But the problem is, unless it's a one-off freaky event, if it's just to cover your day-to-day living expenses, all you've done is then made it even more difficult to do it next month. So if you had to borrow 10% of next month's salary to live this month, next month you get 90% to pay 110%, so you need to borrow 20% of the following month's salary. And that's the problem. Scottish football over that 88 to 92 window borrowed money to excel on the pitch.
Yeah, well, it extended long beyond that.
Then the Tories won the 92 election because Labour were running on a "we'll ditch the Taylor Report" agenda as part of it, and everybody, a bit like the election just passed, nobody expected Tories to win. Tories won, and nobody in Scottish football had done their stake.
Mm-hmm.
English football had, nobody in Scotland had. So we'd already spent tomorrow's money on the park, and suddenly somebody said, we also need tomorrow's money to build the stadium now, or you're closing your doors.
Yeah.
So it was a double whammy, and it's taken 20 years for Scottish football to readjust.
And Scottish football was in that bubble around, well, pretty much the creation of the SPL, when the Sky money was decent, and they made the brief BBC live deal, and then Setanta came along.
Yeah.
And it existed in a bubble where, well, that cash is always going
to
be there.
Yeah, because every time they thought we're about to run out of cash, they got they won a small lottery.
Yeah.
Which allowed them to just keep going, and then allowed the principle of, we can always spend next year's money because next year's money will always be bigger than last year's.
The same thing could happen to English Premier League tomorrow. Okay, it's in a completely, the marketplace is completely different. The fault of the Scottish chairman and chief executives, etc.,